What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 36, and I am talking to Jamie. Jamie has a job that I would imagine most people have never heard of, and his job is that he is a disaster psychologist. And that job is as cool as it sounds. He is such an interesting guy. He goes and studies basically how disasters affect people, how it affects their mental state, and yeah, it's a whole thing. But he also has this institute called the Humanitarian Disaster Institute. It's at Wheaton College. My good friend Laura actually works for the institute, and so he has this institute, and it is training people and helping people, churches, understand what to do in disasters. It's such a cool ministry. Jamie also has a book that came out yesterday, actually. It's called A Walking Disaster, and it's about his story and how his story shapes his work, and how people can better, you know, cope and deal with traumas behind disasters and that sort of thing. So it's such a cool story. I guarantee you this story is going to blow your mind. He has an amazing story. It is just so clear how God shaped his story and has used his story to fuel his work and what he does now. It's the, you know, his burden for helping people in these predicaments is just incredible. And so you're going to love this interview. You've got to check out all of his stuff, the Institute, the book. He actually runs a master's program for people who want to do this as their calling. Such good stuff. So yes, you're going to love this. I'm excited about it. Obviously, I'm going to go ahead and remind you, as I do every time, that I would love a rating and review on iTunes or whatever app you use. That greatly goes towards helping get the word out about A Theology of Hustle. I would love a share. Just getting Jamie's story out there, I think, is worthwhile, and what he has going on that I think people don't even realize. So on your social media or whatever, make sure you share this episode so that people can find out all about it. You can follow me on Instagram at Theology of Hustle if you would like. I'm always posting stuff there, and make sure you are following me on all the socials so you stay up to date with what's coming out. And yeah, I'm so excited. Please get on and let me know what you think. I would love to hear what you think about Jamie's story and the work that he does. And I hope you enjoy this interview with Jamie. All right, Jamie. Well, I really appreciate you being willing to come on the podcast and chat with me. It's nice to meet you officially.
Yeah, likewise. Excited to be here.
We like know all the same people, but, you know, have never met each other. So it's good stuff. So why don't we jump off with the podcast by just having you sort of introduce yourself to everyone?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a small little rural farming community of about 1,000 people, and ended up studying psychology as a career path. And then upon finishing up my doctorate, my very first teaching gig was at Southern Miss, and we moved into Southern Mississippi just 6 days before Hurricane Katrina hit.
Wow. That is crazy.
Yeah, so that really kind of like set the path for the work that I'm doing now. It's most of which I would have never expected that this is what I would be doing professionally or as a ministry. So I sometimes joke that I've often been in the wrong place at the right time. So that's kind of summed up most of my life up to this point.
I love, yeah, that is just, so you would say that 2005 experience in Katrina sort of paved the way for everything that you do now?
Yeah, it was completely, you know, changed everything I thought I was going to do around, you know, everything kind of upside down. And yeah. I mean, in some cases, literally, right? Like with the hurricane,
right.
When Katrina hit, that I went down there and I thought that I was going to end up researching rural, like mental health disparities,
yeah.
And that I would be driving up north to work up in the Mississippi Delta, which is a very poverty driven area, and specifically wanted to work with churches there on helping them deal with mental health issues. And then next thing I know, you know, the storm comes in that, in fact, we actually didn't even know that Katrina was going to hit us, that because we moved in, hadn't been there a week yet, and my cell phone, we had come from the Chicago area, so we got no signal. We lived out in the country. Our house, we had no cable yet, and so I tried to put foil on the TV antennas and couldn't get a signal, so we had no TV, and we knew no one other than, you know, who I worked with. So when I left work on Friday, we knew that Katrina was in the coming the general direction of the southeast, but we thought it was going to hit on the other side of Louisiana. And then over the course of the weekend, it shifted, and we had no idea. And so it was going to come up right between Louisiana and Mississippi, and ultimately it came right over the community where we lived. But we didn't even know about it coming towards us until we went to church that Sunday morning before it struck.
That is, I mean, that story is mind-boggling to me. Okay, so let's back up, because I wanna get the context for this. So why did you go down to Mississippi? Mississippi? Did you already have sort of you were on a career path, correct?
Yeah, I was on a career path that, you know, I knew I wanted to teach, but I didn't realize how important research was until I started going on the job market and started interviewing at all these different places. And suddenly I realized that a lot of the questions I was asking was like, what kind of resources are there to do research? And how can we turn this research into resources or trainings or interventions that are going to actually help communities? You know, I'd kind of seen myself as just always, you know, teaching a bunch of courses, and, you know, that was all I was really looking for. But then when I was doing the interviews, realized I actually was really driven a lot by research. Huh.
So you're a psychologist? Do you have a degree in psychology?
Yeah, so my PhD is in counseling psychology.
Counseling psychology. Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, and so, you know, a big part of it for me too was that in some ways I'm kind of an unlikely researcher that, you know, growing up I was like in remedial reading, you know, like I remember having all of these like meetings with between my math teacher and my parents of, we're not sure if Jamie's going to pass, you know, what are we going to do here? You know, so I really struggled with school growing up and had never read a book front to cover until I got to college. You know, I had memories of doing book reports of like reading the very front, you know, like maybe the first chapter, skimming a couple pages, reading the back chapter, and then just praying that it was an oral presentation because I could at least maybe tell a joke or a story that would distract my teacher enough that maybe I could still squeak out a decent grade. Wow. But if I had to write it down, I was going to struggle probably. So, you know, again, very kind of unexpected for me.
Wow. So you kind of struggled through school, got into college and started going down the college path, right?
Yeah. So I'm a first generation college student. Okay. And initially had a couple opportunities to do actually music as a scholarship at a couple different schools. And all through high school, I remember thinking like, you know, hopefully my instrument will get me into school, because otherwise,
saxophone.
Okay. I was like, there's no other way I'm getting into the college, you know, if it's not for music. But then at the end of my senior year of high school, realized that I'm not good enough to play professionally, and I'm not going to be a good fit as a band director. So I really was like, oh, what am I going to do? It kind of went through this little mini crisis and went to a junior college just about 30 minutes or so from the cornfields where I grew up, and still used music so I could, you know, afford to go to school. But then ended up trying, you know, changing my major, I don't know, like three or four different times, and had a professor named Ed Fitch. And he was a psych professor, and just everything he was talking about, like, really kind of fascinated me. Yeah. And that's when I really got connected to there. And then I had another professor named John Makowski, who I'd written some paper for like a English 101 course. And he asked to see me after class. And so he's like, so Jamie's like, are you a Christian? I'm like, yeah. And then his next question was, why? And I just remember being shocked by the question, and I didn't have an answer. Huh. And so I ended up going to meet with my youth pastor, and he like loaded me up, you know, books from, you know, like my waist all the way up to my chin. And I read C.S. Lewis for the first time, Mere Christianity. And from that point, I couldn't stop reading, and just started going through it, and started meeting with this professor who on a good day was an agnostic, other days, you know, an atheist. And he would give me a book on philosophy or maybe a yogi that he was reading about. And I'd give him a book from C.S. Lewis, and we'd swap and get together. And he just really, you know, so I was mentored by an atheist.
Gosh, that is so crazy. So you go from like sort of rural, you know, growing up on literally on a farm to getting into college and just like experiencing sort of the world of academia and just sort of never stopped.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, John was really important to me because I remember early on in one of our conversations, he's like, so were you like valedictorian or, you know, in your high school? And I just remember cracking up laughing because that was farthest from my academic performance at that point. But he really helped me see that there was maybe more to me than I realized. And yeah, so I kept reading and started seeking out mentors, and they really helped, you know, put me on this career path that I never dreamed of.
Wow. Okay. Crazy. So, so you go through, you get the PhD, all this stuff, you end up down in Mississippi. So can you like sort of describe what some of your like feel like, how did you and your wife sort of process like, hey, we just moved here and are about to be destroyed. Like, what is that? Yeah.
Well, it's like, I couldn't even get my head around like what is happening, you know? So like that Sunday morning when we learned about it, we attended this kind of like large Southern Baptist church, just like down the road from where we lived. And I remember that morning, my wife, and at the time we only had one daughter, we actually went like through a walk around our neighborhood, and it was just this sense of like peace, like, okay, we're done with grad school. We're finally, you know, like kind of feeling settled, you know, we have a home, and just enjoy, like, I remember the pine trees and the wispy clouds, and just, it was just like this moment of peace and like, okay, we're in a new season of life. And then we go to this church and the pastor like gets up, and the slow Southern draw starts off that Sunday morning by saying, if you remember Camille, you know what I'm about to say. And so I turn to my wife, and she turns to me, and she's like, who's Camille? And I was like, well, she must be in the Old Testament, you know, just kind of joking. Right. And then he starts talking about how Camille, you know, was like this one of the worst natural disasters to ever strike. And it's just like, whoa, where's this going? And then he starts talking about how Katrina now is headed toward our community. And then after the church service was over, you know, my wife and I had always grown up in the north, where, you know, you always had a basement, right? Like, right, if there's a tornado, you go to the basement.
Yeah.
Well, the water table is different in the south, so there's not very many basements. And so we're like, what do we do? And so right afterwards, I start asking people in the pews around, like, hey, we just moved in, we don't know what to do for a hurricane. And I remember this one woman who turns and she's like, oh, bless your heart, which I learned, by the way, is not a compliment.
That's, yes, in the south, that means something different than you think it does.
Took a little while for me to learn that, so that's probably saying something. And she's like, oh, well, bless your heart. She's like, you know, at worst, it's going to be like camping for a few days. And then this other person, you know, in one of the pews was like, oh, they always make a big deal about it, and it never comes our direction, or it fizzles out, or, you know, takes a different turn. You know, don't worry about it. So then we were kind of thinking through it, as, you know, my wife and I, and we ended up stopping at a couple of stores, like, well, we should at least get some supplies. And then realizing like everybody was already sold out of like all the basics. And it's like, okay, this is maybe serious. And we're noticing everybody filling up their cars with gas. So we go back to my office, and we're sitting there, and my wife's sitting beside me, and, you know, daughter on my lap. And I don't know if you've seen the kind of like famous NOAA images of Katrina, the black and white satellite images.
Yeah.
And I just remember seeing this thing take up my entire screen, and just looking at my wife and daughter thinking like, what do we do? What do we do here?
Wow. Okay. So I'm sorry. I'm a little, your story is just so incredible to me. I mean, to never have lived through a hurricane, which I haven't either, I would literally have no idea what to do, right? To be there for 6 days and not have, I mean, you have no community, you have no resources, and to experience one of the worst natural disasters that's ever, you know, happened in America, right? It's pretty mind-boggling. Like, so did y'all weather the storm in Mississippi?
Well, what we ended up doing was we rushed back to the house, and we were trying to decide, like, do we stay? Do we evacuate? And right before we left the Chicago area, there had been like a really bad storm. And we didn't want our young daughter, you know, to have that same, like her first memory of Mississippi being like this bad storm, you know, whether even if it was mild or not. So we thought, okay, well, let's try to pack up the tiny Saturn with what we can, and we'll head out. But before we did that, I started like rifling through like our unpacked boxes. And I remember my wife asking like, what are you doing? I'm like, hold on just a second. Cause I had remembered those, like 9/11, public service announcement ads. You might remember like after there started being all these things, like in the event of, you know, a terrorist attack or a disaster, these are the things you need.
Yeah.
And so I was going through my mind, and I'm going through the boxes, and finally I found what I was looking for, the gold of preparedness. And I pull out of the box a roll of duct tape. Cause all I could remember was that you needed duct tape and like plastic.
Right.
And I'm thinking, wait, how's that going to stop a hurricane? And then I realized, oh, that's for a bioterrorist attack. You know, so I really had no idea what to do. So we packed up what we could in our tiny little four-door Saturn, and we just started driving north. And then we started calling, you know, just, you know, friends and family that we knew along the way. And finally, the first person that picked up was a buddy of mine from grad school that lived in Nashville. So as we were driving along, we'd start listening to the radio. We were actually in that first group to kind of evacuate.
Okay.
So we were kind of ahead of like all that gridlock.
Okay.
And then we were displaced for several weeks before we could ever even like get back into our house.
So what was the... what was it like in your area? Like what was going on?
Yeah, well, you know, so I ended up driving back first without my wife and daughter. And then they eventually came down a couple weeks later just because we had no idea. You know, we were watching the news and seeing everything unfold from a distance, but we couldn't reach anyone there. You know, I mean, we didn't even know who to try to reach, right? The only phone number of anybody I had was my real estate agent.
Yeah.
and so it took weeks before I got a hold of her. And, you know, I remember driving in and just feeling like I had no idea where I was. It looked like a war zone, just driving down the road and I'm pulling into the drive of our subdivision. And just everywhere, there's these pine trees that have just shot into homes and through homes like missiles. And you see all these giant oak trees just completely uprooted, you know, on their side as you're driving in. And signs are gone everywhere and debris all over the road. And just remember feeling this sense of fear of like, what am I going to see when I pull up to our home?
Yeah.
And fortunately, we were very fortunate that we had roof damage and trees down. And debris everywhere, but much less damage than like some of the neighbors or folks close by that completely lost their homes. You know, that when you see a lot of the images from New Orleans, a lot of the damage there was caused by the flood, by the water damage.
Yeah.
But in Mississippi, it was very different. It was largely the wind damage. So there, you know, you had some homes that were completely down to the slab, you know, that's all that was left or that had just been torpedoed by trees.
Gosh, that's incredible. So did y'all end up like moving back into Mississippi?
And we eventually, you know, I'm down there and my parents came with me and we cleared up as much debris and stuff. And I was trying to like put a blue roof is what they call them to patch our roof, which is where you're getting like those big blue thick tarps.
Yeah, yeah.
And like up on the roof trying to, you know, prevent as much water damage as I could and practically falling off. I'm not a very handy person, but it was good enough to keep more damage from happening. And then so eventually once I was able to get the house and the debris cleared up, you know, my wife and daughter came and joined. And that was the start of our new life in South Mississippi. It was quite the welcome.
Man, what a way to get started.
Yeah.
Right? Gosh. So, I mean, I guess you were on a trajectory, right? You were teaching at Mississippi State?
University of Southern Mississippi.
Southern Mississippi, sorry. Mm-hmm. So you were teaching there. How did that event sort of affect your career?
Yeah. Well, you know, it really set it on a whole different direction that even though I'd only been on campus for, you know, less than a week, right away I had already recruited some grad students, some doc students to be a part of a research lab with me. And okay. So we were going to study rural mental health disparities in the Delta. Like that was the plan. So I already had a group together. And then campus was closed for around a month or so. And then once it finally reopened, I remember our college president coming and he gave a talk and he said that whatever you were doing before Katrina, you should try to engage your students in those same things after that, you know, try to help them have a sense of normalcy. Mm-hmm. You know, so I pulled together my lab team and we start talking about research. And one of my students was like, why are we talking about going to the Delta when there's disaster mental health needs, you know, right here in our own community? Why aren't we doing something here?
Yeah.
And so I sat down and I gave one of my students the marker and we as a team started brainstorming about what would it look like to do this kind of rural community health, mental health type of work, but to focus it on disasters. And so we then within a couple of weeks started doing research and started trying to understand the connection between faith and resilience among those that we were serving in our community. And then that led to starting to work with churches and then doing trainings with churches. And never looked back after that.
Yeah, it's just so incredible how one event like that, and obviously it was a traumatic event, but one event like that can just so drastically alter everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like, cause it's funny. Cause I had somebody ask me once, like, so did you go to school for like disasters? And I was like, well, you know, thinking back, I think I had a professor one day, he was lecturing on trauma and he kind of coughed. And I think he may have said the word disaster while he coughed. And that was pretty much the extent of my training.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, you know, we're in the adoption world. We have our youngest is adopted. So we do a lot around trauma, right?
Yeah.
My wife and I, but it's like children and it's specific to adoption and foster care. Is the trauma of disaster relief different than other traumas? I mean, does that question even make sense?
Yeah, yeah, okay. No, totally does. Okay. You know, so there's definitely a lot of like similarities, you know, from all these different, you know, whether somebody's combat trauma or going through a natural disaster or, you know, even like thinking like foster care, you know, these sorts of traumas.
Yeah.
There's definitely connections, but there's also, I think, some uniqueness. And one of the things with like my main focus is on like mass disasters. So, you know, not just natural disasters, but it might be like terrorist attacks or a mass shooting, you know, these sorts of events. And one of the differences is that oftentimes when people share their stories about trauma, it tends to be like maybe there's another person who, you know, was the offender toward that person that caused it, or there was like a car accident where there was maybe a handful of people. But one of the things that's unique about disasters is that you're looking at that experience now being shared by hundreds, if not thousands of people. And occasionally some events, like if you look at some mass scale, like terrorist attacks, that even though it's not directly affecting people, sometimes, I mean, there's definitely a group that is directly affected, but its impact can ripple out, you know, across countries. Or, you know, even if you look at like when the Paris terrorist attacks happened there, suddenly here in the US, everybody on Facebook, you know, has like we stand with Paris types of images.
Yeah, right.
You know, so we even felt the effects here.
Yeah.
And so one of the big differences is that, you know, it's impacting everyone in your life. Huh. And that's one of the kind of unique challenges of overcoming a mass scale disaster.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So like disrupts your social networks in a unique way.
Yeah.
You know, natural disasters are kind of unique that we found from others where people sometimes respond to them maybe a little differently, especially around faith.
Sure.
Where like if it's a combat issue or if it's a terrorist attack, I can point to someone else, maybe even physically touch, you know, that person. But like a natural disaster, where's the blame go? Where's the source of it? You know, like our insurance company calls them acts of God, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know, so people are more likely to make what we would call on the research side, like a causal attribution to God.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, did God have a role in that? So you see people's faith being evoked sometimes in different ways because of the cause.
Right. Because when it's a person, right, you can account for sort of personal evil, right?
In your
brain, you could sort of rationalize that in certain ways. You've seen that, but.
Mm-hmm. But here's this almost like this randomness.
Yeah.
You know, how do you make sense of that randomness, or why did it happen?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. We're going to dig more into that because I really enjoy that. I want to jump back on your personal train though, because Katrina was not the only major sort of trauma that you've been through, right? Do you mind talking about your cancer experience?
So we were in South Mississippi for 5 years, and then I was recruited to come here to Wheaton College. And part of the negotiations was I asked them to be able to start a new center, the Humanitarian Disaster Institute, to be able to keep doing that type of disaster work, and had only been here for a few years. And then at the age of 35, started having some pretty severe pains. Well, actually, like a year before, I had some weird symptoms that had gone to a doctor and referred me to a specialist. And the specialist was like, you know, eat some more fiber. You're going to be okay. If the symptoms come back and see me.
Right.
And then it's like a year goes by, seemed to be doing fine. And then out of nowhere, I start getting like these weird shooting pains in my back and down my legs, and my stomach's hurting all the time and having some other things going on. And so I go back to the doctor at this point, and immediately they want to have some more testing done. And I find out that I just was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer.
Stage 4? I mean, that's like, I don't know the stages that well. What is that?
That's the worst stage.
That's what I thought.
There's no stage 5.
Right.
Maybe research has changed, but at the time of my diagnosis, like,
I mean, you're like at the worst.
Yeah. So it meant that the cancer had spread. Mm. So it had got, and so the reason why I was having all those kind of weird pains in my legs was that I had the cancer tumor in my colon, and then it had spread to a mass that was sitting on a nerve bundle. So had it not been for that mass on my nerve bundle, I probably would have just ignored the other symptoms because they weren't that bad.
Wow.
And so that's why I was getting all those shooting pains. So it had spread, which is why I had the stage 4 diagnosis.
Wow. Wow. So yeah, talk to me a little bit just about that journey. What was that like?
Yeah, well, it was kind of like going back to that feeling of after Katrina struck when I was, you know, at home in my house, like holding up duct tape, you know, like trying to combat, you know, this hurricane, like, yeah. What do I do?
Yeah.
And when I first got the news, I mean, I fell apart, right?
You know, sure.
And sitting there with the oncologist and starting to tear up and, you know, starting to sob. And so he's trying to like kind of calm me down a little bit. And, you know, so with this kind of like best bedside manner, he's like, well, you know, he's like, what is it you do for a living? So I share, well, I'm a professor, but I also direct this disaster research center. And he just kind of pauses and he's like, well, you're in for your own personal disaster. And that was quite true.
Wow. Yeah, that's never what you want to hear from the doctor, is it?
Right. No, it's not. Because like, you know, I joke with friends and family that I'm pathologically optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, that I, like, I'm always trying to look for good in the you know, and look for opportunities even in difficult times.
Yeah.
And it was really hard for me. Like, I remember telling my parents when I called them to let them know, like initially, after I shared the news, I was like, well, at least we caught it early. And I was like, but wait, no, we actually didn't.
Yeah, right.
We caught it really, really late.
Yeah.
You know, it's really aggressive. And but it was so hard. And in fact, I couldn't even let others say the words stage 4. Like, it's only been within maybe the last year or so that I can even have a conversation like this about it. That, you know, to say it out loud, I felt like how can I fight this? Because, you know, as a researcher, you know, numbers had always been my friend,
sure.
You know, in the scholarship that I'd done. But then as I looked at the numbers and started looking at like mortality rates and stuff,
yeah.
You know, it was just overwhelming, you know, the odds. And yeah. I felt like if I'm going to fight this, I need to not focus on just the statistic that I've become, and have to focus on, you know, that I'm more than just a number.
Wow. Yeah. Numbers are no longer your friends at that point.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Wow. So I don't want to belabor your process though, but what is it like? I mean, what was it like fighting stage 4 colon cancer? Yeah.
It was by far the scariest thing I've ever gone through. Oh. You know, like when Katrina hit, you know, that was scary, but like my family and I were able to pack up and get out of harm's
sure.
way.
Yeah. Right.
And then, you know, we had to come back and live in it, but there was a sense of distance that I could create.
Yeah.
But this time the disaster was inside of me.
Right.
That I couldn't get away from it. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's where like the title of my new book, A Walking Disaster, comes from. That everywhere I went, this was always with me. And the hardest part though was the fact that I had 3 young daughters and just wondering, like, am I going to be there?
Right.
And like, I had this one moment where I dropped one of my youngest daughter off at preschool at the time. And as I was walking away, realizing that if I don't make it, kind of had that thought back to like developmental psychology back in undergrad, you know, where you learn like kids' memories and all of this, of realizing like, oh my gosh, like, most of her memories will be what other people tell her, not actually of me. And you know, I walked into the bathroom and I just sobbed. And it was like not just crying. It's like the ugly, you know, like whole body shaking, eventually going to like dry crying where there's no sound coming out, but you're still shaking. Right. And those type of moments would just take over. And I remember at one point where that was really happening for me, that, you know, these kind of moments of just the suffering that I was experiencing, where eventually I was able to go see a psychologist. And, but I was like, you know, I even gave myself my own depression scale, you know, so like I gave myself a standardized test and scored it. And I was like, but I don't meet the criteria of a major depressive episode. And, my psychologist was also a Christian, and she's like, Jamie, I wonder if you're lamenting, if that's what is happening. And it was, and I was lamenting the loss of my possible future. But you know, so the emotional part, I think, was the hardest.
Yeah.
even now, just kind of talking about like feel you know, getting choked up a little bit. But then the physical part too, I had never gone through anything like this where that first summer for the whole time I did oral chemotherapy twice a day, and I did radiation 5 days a week. And I remember like doing this one morning, getting ready to take my chemo medicine, and it had a little warning of like, do not touch or let come in contact with skin. Mm. And it was actually recommended that, you know, you take it like wearing plastic gloves. And as I'm getting ready to put it in my mouth, I'm like, and I'm going to digest this.
Yeah, right.
I'm doing this to myself.
It's not safe for my skin, but.
Right. But I'm going to put this in my body. Right.
Gosh.
And I mean, those treatments just like beat me down. Mm. And one of the traditions that we often did when our girls were young was we'd go to Brookfield Zoo right before school in August. And by that point, it was, you know, towards the end of my treatments, and I wasn't sure if I was even going to have the physical strength to do it.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know what? This is a tradition. It's important. You know, we still need to figure out how to live some during this period of struggle. And we go, and I was probably only there like maybe a half an hour, and I was just, that was it. Like I was done. And so I had to rent like one of those little scooters to like get around the zoo. And I remember getting actually some dirty looks from a couple of people because, you know, at the time I was only 35.
Yeah, right.
On the outside, you wouldn't really, you know, I had a hat on, and so, you know, so like you wouldn't really know anything was wrong. And I just remember, you know, feeling like I needed to sign this as like, I have cancer.
Right. Right.
But you know, and so it was kind of like a, so you grew up in Texas. Did you ever go to tractor pools?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that was definitely part of like my youth. Like that was the big event every year, the 4-H fair, and we'd have the big tractor pool contest. So that was the,
love it.
And you know, with the tractor pool, like the weight that they put behind the tractor, technically speaking and physically, it's the same weight, right? But then the further they go, it gets heavier because of the change, the leverage that it has as it starts to ramp up, right?
Right.
And that's what cancer was like for me and my treatments, that, you know, I went through this experience, and the further I went, just the heavier and heavier that it got and the more that it pulled on me. And then so finally, at the end of that summer, I finished treatments, took a little bit of time to try to recover a little bit, and then I had to go into a major surgery. It took about a half a day, and they removed like the tumor and the mass and all kinds of other things. And I was in the hospital for several weeks. And then when I got home, I was pretty much bedridden for about a month, where, you know, I had to have help just getting up to go to the bathroom. Or even walking. And then just about the time that I start to get recovered just a little bit from that experience, then my doctor recommends another 6 months of drip chemo. And I remember when he told me that it felt kind of like it felt hearing the news of cancer, because I finally thought I was on the other side of it. And I didn't think I was going to have the strength to do another 6 months.
Wow. Well, and I guess, your doctor was correct with that extra 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. 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 Well, and I kind of, you know, initially when he gave it to me, I kind of fought him a little bit of like, okay, if I'm going to do this, like you need to give me some research. I want to see some, you know, like clinical trial data or outcome data that this is the right choice.
Yeah.
And so, one of his staff ends up sending me like a link to some generic website, like, I don't know, you know, it doesn't really have any real research on it.
Right.
Just like, hey, here's some different treatments. And so like I called back and I was like, actually, I just finished co-editing a book on evidence-based practices. Like when I'm asking for trial data, I'm actually asking for the real data.
Right.
A meta-analysis would be fine, but I actually want data to make this decision. If you're going to do this to me, you've got to show me some research on it.
Yeah.
And so he ends up like sending me, you know, like good empirical studies and stuff. And for why that should happen. And then the next time I showed up, he's like, so now I want you to bring me some research on different like social strategies that people can do that bolsters resilience. So then we started exchanging some data and research back and forth a little bit.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Really cool. I feel like your doctor should just know his audience, right? I
mean, right, right.
You're not going to be swayed by some website with no actual, you know, evidence. Yeah. You're a researcher.
Yeah. Right? So I'm pretty sure I was probably a pretty difficult patient.
I probably made him be a better doctor, though, right? Yeah. get all that stuff out there. Okay. I can't help but like want to go down the book trail now, though, because your book, A Walking Disaster, is all about that. I mean, it's about your story and how your story sort of collides with what you do for a job, right?
So yeah.
Do you mind just, let's talk about the book a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I'm also really grateful that it's now been 4.5 years of no evidence of disease.
Wow.
And so in the book, I really kind of share my story and my journey mm-hmm. of, you know, my oncologist had said, you know, you're in for your personal disaster.
Yeah.
You know, so I had spent years studying disasters all over the globe about how they impact people's faith and resilience. But then when I went through cancer, it really helped me understand those lessons in a whole different way.
Yeah.
That, you know, in some ways, it really kind of challenged what I thought I knew about faith and resilience.
Huh. Yeah. How so? How?
Well, in some ways, it was very... very kind of that kind of idea of this very kind of counterintuitive that, you know, I oftentimes thought about resilience as our ability to like bounce back from difficult times.
Yeah.
But when I was going through cancer, it was a struggle because I had people that would say, Jamie, you know, you're really resilient. You're an example of resilience. And when people would say that to me, I actually felt like a phony because like I knew the technical, you know, research definitions and I didn't fit those. Like I wasn't bouncing back. You know, I had no strength left in my body. And as I started going through the cancer experience, you know, starting to realize that, you know, it just challenged kind of everything that I knew. Like one of the ways that I learned about combating trauma was that you kind of challenge the thoughts of trauma, you know, that you try to stop them. But then when I had, for the very first time in my life, had intrusive thoughts and kind of had a flashback of instead of fighting it, trying to accept it. And, you know, and there's some research to show that on like acceptance therapies and things of just kind of letting the pain wash over me rather than trying to fight it. Or when I thought about meaning, I felt like I had to have an answer to why this was happening, but then ultimately realizing there was never going to be an answer to make this all right again. But learning that even though God doesn't promise to give us an answer, he does promise to give of himself, you know? So these were kind of the lessons I was learning, or a big one too for me that had like a direct tie back to a study that I had done was on spiritual surrender. So after Katrina, we did this study and found that people who engaged in higher levels of spiritual resilience or a spiritual surrender ended up viewing God as being in more control and more loving. And I can still remember sitting in my tiny little concrete office in my little brown, like kind of tweed 1970s chair I had inherited as the newbie in the department. You can hear it kind of squeak, you know, right?
Yeah.
And going through the data and not liking what I found. Mm. Because as I read it, it just kind of reminded me of like the country songs, kind of like and I apologize to any Carrie Underwood fans here, but of like, Jesus, take the wheel. Like, I'm just going to throw up my hands and I have no role in this.
Right.
You know, it felt very passive.
Yeah.
And then there was this one particular day as I was going through the second round of chemo, and it caused me a lot of nerve issues. So like I was super sensitive to cold, like it felt, you know, it was very painful. And this one morning, I remember being happy that I had enough strength to help take the trash cans out to the curb. Mm. And it was winter. And as I'm taking the trash cans out, I'm all bundled up. I probably looked like I was about to rob somebody's house. Like, you know, I had so many layers and masks and scarves on, gloves, all in black. And taking them to the curb. And the whole time I'm praying, like, God, heal me. God, take this cancer from me. You know, God, let me be okay. And as I get to the curb and I drop off the cans, I pause because I'm exhausted and I take a deep breath. And when I do, my scarf falls down and I inhale all this cold winter air. And it just felt like I was gargling glass.
Yeah.
And as I start to try to walk back to the house to get back to the warmth, my prayers switch from asking God to heal me to now thinking about, you know, does God work this way? Can God heal me? Will he heal me? Is there even a God?
Yeah.
And then finally make it upstairs to my bedroom. And before I hop into bed, I fall to my knees and my prayer changes. And it goes from God, take this to, you know, God, please be with my wife and my daughters if I'm not okay. And that was by far the hardest prayer I've ever had to pray in my life. And in that moment, I had this kind of awareness that, you know, spiritual surrender isn't this kind of passive act. You know, it's not a bad country song. True spiritual surrender is, it's a willful act of obedience, of trusting God that even if things don't turn out okay in this life, for me, that God's still going to take care of my family.
Gosh, that is, that's powerful. Yeah. Wow. It reminds me a lot of Jesus, right? But like his surrender to the Father's will,
yeah,
you know, is that's what he was doing, right?
Right. And I don't think I'd ever really, for whatever reason, there had been this kind of disconnect for me between those types of examples. And, you know, you're talking about like kind of Christ example going before us. I remember there was this one morning when I was going through radiation, which I don't know if you ever watched the kids cartoon Phineas and Ferb.
Oh, yeah. Actually,
and,
I do. Yeah.
Right. And there's the evil Dr. Doofenshmirtz, who always has like these enators and like these lasers and everything. Well, I took my girls early on to see what the radiation machine looked like so they wouldn't be scared. And and one of them joked of, oh, it's like one of Dr. Doofenshmirtz's inventions.
That's right? So good.
So, but... later on, and not such a humorous example, I was having radiation, and I remember they were kind of like slowly rolling me in for the treatment as I'm laying down to put me under like the laser there. And I remember just feeling totally alone, you know, like I'm only 35, I've got a young family. You know, everybody else that I was hearing that says, oh, I know exactly what this is like, you know, they had already raised their families, you know, much older than what I was. And I just was really feeling alone in that moment and kind of feeling sorry for myself. It's kind of having a pity party.
And
as I'm getting ready to kind of go into this like cave-like structure of the laser and everything, I had this image of Christ going into the tomb and then, you know, as I came out of him being raised from the tomb, and just remembered that no matter what I was going through, what any of us go through, Christ has already been there and that he's conquered ultimately death.
Man, that's, yeah. What a powerful picture of the gospel and, Man.
You know, I'm thinking though, if this whole like disaster thing doesn't work out, I want to write like greeting cards for Hallmark, you know, like to write, like take some time. I think maybe that's what I need at some point, like just to focus on things that are like happy and cheerful. Because one of my girls was helping me organize my books in my office a while back. And she's like, Dad, where does this go? And I was like, oh, everything on the right are like the worst things that can happen to people. So just put it over there. So maybe it's time I need to, you know, like more rainbows and unicorns and some cheerful things in life.
Well, I think Phineas and Ferb, you know, is a great way to do some of that, right?
Right, right.
It's very cheerful, you know. My wife talks about that a lot. She's a therapist. And like when you come home, you can't, like you've been in all of that all day, right? You need your entertainment to not be that. Maybe there's another career there, you know, once you're all done. It's like the rainbow and sunshine of Hallmark cards. Although you might be too much of a realist in many of them, you know.
Probably not.
Gosh, that is that's powerful. And so the book is looking at ways in which we can understand sort of disasters in our own lives and in the lives of those around us and some of that stuff, right?
Yeah. So after I found out that you know, there was no evidence of cancer and finally started to bounce back some, and by bounce back, it was a slow bounce. So it almost took about 9 months for me to kind of start to get back to just how I operated cognitively or even physically, you know, that I had some friends that work, I do a lot of my research with. And I remember over that 9 months, probably about every 2 to 3 months, I would send out an email like, hey guys, I'm back. Like I finally, like this morning, like I feel like, you know, my brain's firing on all cylinders. I think I'm finally there. And then like another few months would go by and then I would all of a sudden have this kind of big jump in like activity or ability to think more clear and be like, oh, no, this time I'm really back. But that just kept happening for like 9 months. Mm. And so I didn't even realize like how beaten down I was. But eventually I was able to get a sabbatical. And on that sabbatical, one of the things I did was I went back through and I read the journal that I kept. And one of the types of research that I do is called qualitative research. So it's not just the numbers. It's the kind of like analyzing the narrative or, you know, words and stories that people tell. And so I went through and I started like analyzing my own journal and looking at like what were the themes that came out of this. And what I realized was that virtues really played a big part of my journey through this, that, you know, trying to struggle with making meaning or trying to find ways to be grateful even during difficult times, or trying to distinguish and understand hope from optimism, that those were all what I realized were kind of like these building blocks that all of us have access to. And another big kind of takeaway that I had from this book and reflecting on my cancer journey was, you know, a lot of resilience focuses on trying to get through a disaster to then be able to get back to life. Yeah. But for a lot of people, you know, like myself, that sometimes those disasters don't, you know, like Katrina came and was over Mississippi in about a day, right? So, but cancer hovered over me for a year. So that recovery is going to be a lot longer for in some ways for people that have chronic health issues, for example. And what I realized was that I had to learn how to live still in the suffering. And that's when I really started to better understand and start to research spiritual fortitude. And so throughout the book, I kind of share that journey, and I try to share honestly stories of not just went well, because a lot of it is also about what I didn't do well and where my struggles were, and try to be authentic as much as I could about that. And then also incorporate stories from the different disasters that I've worked or helped with, you know, around the globe, and bring those kind of points of connection into the story for the reader.
Wow. That's such good stuff. Yeah. I really appreciate you being willing to share your story with us. And, you know, it's really cool. It's really cool. Something I don't want to neglect, though, in all of this is your humanitarian disaster institute, right? Like, I've been in ministry a long time. It never even like occurred to me that this type of ministry, like disaster relief, was even a necessary part of ministry, right? So can you talk a little bit just about like the formation of that and what it even, what the Institute does? And...
Yeah, well, don't feel bad, because I helped start this and I never had the vision for it either previous to Katrina.
Okay, that's
what you're talking about. So I sometimes joke that the reason why I'm a disaster psychologist is because I'm not the most observant of psychologists, that the good thing about a disaster is you always know what's wrong, right?
Yeah, like, you're right.
You can't miss the problem.
Right.
But for me, it was noticing that after Katrina, that oftentimes it was the local congregations and local churches that were the very first to respond. Mm-hmm. And then over our time there, as you started to see other relief organizations or emergency management groups eventually start to leave, that it was still the local churches that were there helping for the long term. And I was just blown away by the amazing ways that I saw churches help. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I also saw a lot of people whose hearts were in the right place, but ended up causing harm unintentionally.
Interesting.
You know, so whenever you think about working with trauma, you want to make sure you're actually helping. Yeah. And, yeah. I saw examples where, like, there was a church up north somewhere that raised like $60,000, and they rented a large semi and filled the whole back end with frozen meals to send down south to help after Katrina. But you probably, I can already tell from your smile that you're like, well, there's a problem with that. And you're right. Yeah. Like, so there was no electricity. So one, there was no way to heat them up to eat the food that they sent, and there was no way to keep it cold.
Yeah,
so it just actually rotted by the side of the road in the back of the semi.
Semi truck full of, wow.
I saw experiences where, you know, even like some sermons that I felt like I had heard that were likely to have caused, you know, even more pain for people who were suffering, hearing people in the church pews trying to help each other and saying things that I knew was causing harm to the person they were trying to help. And as I started watching, I also had this experience where I remember, so Biloxi and Gulfport are kind of like sister cities, okay. You know, separated by the water there, and had been working with churches in both of those communities. And I remember this one group asked me to come in, and they wanted to show this new manual that they had created. And they'd spent a ton of money developing it over the course of like 6-7 months, something like that. And I was like, oh, this is great. But did you know, just across over there to that city, they also just developed a manual almost identical to what you just did. And then, not to make matters worse, but Salvation Army, the Southern Baptist Disaster Relief, you know, all these other groups, they also have manuals on the same topic already.
Right.
And what I saw was also a lot of people reinventing the wheel,
yeah,
or not knowing where to go for resources,
yeah.
Or sometimes there's maybe too many resources, but how do you distinguish what's actually helpful from what's not? And so early on in that process, I remember being down in over in Gulfport and standing by this church that had just been completely gutted out, and just really kind of having this mental picture, this vision for a center that could help churches kind of sort through those issues and to use science to help inform our faith and have our faith inform, you know, our science. And so that's when I got here, started HDI, which is the country's first faith-based academic disaster research center.
That is so cool. I love that. And it's such a personal part of who you are and what you've been through, right? It's just like, yeah, all of your being sort of can go into this, like helping churches like do something really important, right?
So. Yeah, and you know, I think it even kind of goes back even to kind of my rural roots that, you know, that always just valuing the practical of, you know, well, so you may know this knowledge, but if you can't put it to use at the end of the day, what's it good for, right?
Yeah.
And so as an institute, kind of one of our driving goals is that we don't just use science for science sake, but that we use it to empower churches and communities affected by disaster. So that's why we develop like tools and resources. And also, I'm really excited to share that this past August, we even launched a brand new master's program in humanitarian and disaster leadership.
That is so cool. I love that. I've gotten to see this journey sort of from afar, you know, and just see like the master's program is this, it's a huge step. Right. I mean, is there anything like that? Like,
yeah. I mean, there's some other disaster programs around, but this is the first one from a Christian perspective to really focus on these issues.
That is so cool. So what does it look like to go through a master's program in disaster relief?
Yeah, well, the way that we've tried to structure it is to make it really hands-on.
Yeah.
You know, so the program can be done in person on campus in about a year's time, including summers, or people can do it part-time over a couple of years where they come to campus for a couple of weeks and then the rest of it is online. But, you know, like this past fall, in one of the courses that I teach on disaster preparedness, you know, we had one day where everybody was pretending to be like members of a new ministry in their congregation. And as they're talking about, you know, how to get this ministry launched, I kind of switch gears on them and I end up putting in, we had these two big TV screens and it's got these cool speakers in the classroom I was in. And I put on this video of like breaking news, you know, bum, bum, bum.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's been this chemical spill.
Uh-huh.
And so now I'm like, imagine that you're actually in your church. And we had talked about like what community we were in and all of this. So had all these details. Now imagine that this chemical spill just happened. Like, what do you do?
Right.
And, you know, just having the students start to think through, like, what would our steps be to do, you know, carry out a disaster ministry? And then about the time they're getting it, you know, I bring in another news clip of how it's just escalating and getting worse, right?
Yeah.
And so they're kind of working through and thinking about how to help in their communities. And then in another class that my colleague Kent Annan teaches, which, who, by the way, has got a great new book out on welcoming immigrants and refugees. And
that's awesome. I'll make sure and put that in the show notes so everybody can
find
all that.
Great resource.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But Kent teaches a course on NGO leadership, and he actually broke the students into small groups, and they ended up creating their own kind of mini NGOs and filling out like what the paperwork would look like. How would you fundraise? How would you lead them? What would your mission be? And then ended up bringing in the rest of our team from the Institute and others from around campus. And we had kind of like a mini Shark Tank where they all pitched their NGOs. And then we all got to vote on which one we, you know, thought was the strongest.
Wow. That's really
so we try to make it real hands on that. And then coming up, we're excited. In May, we're going to be going to a camp and spend a week running our students through like live crisis humanitarian simulations out in the woods. So, and then they go on to internship from there.
Wow. That's, yeah. I just think it's such important work because I mean, like I said, I would have no idea what to do. I mean, you don't even know unless you've thought through this beforehand, like you don't even know necessarily what's helpful and what's unhelpful, like you said, right? Like if you're just sort of winging it, I feel like, there's a lot of right. room for error and like there's no time to think in a crisis. I mean, right. it's just... You're making decisions on the fly and I think to not be prepared at all to make those decisions can, cause some detriment, right?
Oh yeah. And one of the things too that over the last, goodness, I guess it's been almost like 13 years now that I've been doing this type of work that, initially I was primarily just doing disaster work, but then from doing disaster work, started becoming aware of people getting displaced, which then led me to doing work overseas with refugees. And then from there, starting to realize how public health issues are connected to disasters, and then that trafficking, oftentimes spikes up after disasters. So in our program, we don't just teach about disasters, but also these other kind of humanitarian issues like the refugee issues or creation care, looking at public health issues, so anti-trafficking. And so we also look at these other topics that are so kind of tied in oftentimes to mass traumas.
Wow. I'd never even considered all the
yeah,
other
so
stuff.
Those yeah. pieces are, that's the other part too, that it's connected to so many other issues. So one of the things that I just love about being here at Wheaton is about the opportunity with our master's program that it's interdisciplinary.
Sure.
So like Kent and I are teaching things and I'm coming from a psychologist perspective. He's coming from a development, perspective and pastoral background. And I'm coming from more of the disaster piece. And then we have colleagues and other faculty from all across campus. One of our instructors is coming from an engineering perspective. Another person's coming from economics. That's one of the things I love about being on this campus is you've got this rich interdisciplinary, colleagues and conversation that's happening and that we try to happen in our program.
Yeah. I mean, and like you said, you just have to be practical. You have to be hands-on, right? This is like, so it's cool that you have all those facets involved in all of that. So, and you also, I mean, you don't mess around, right? Like you have a conference that y'all do, like you're just kind of moving and shaking, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely stay busy. That's for sure. So, in addition to our master's program and, so a lot of this is all just, but really what we're doing now, most of it I never dreamt of, like when I first started the Institute, it was kind of like, me and a website and that was about it. And the website wasn't necessarily anything to write home about, so it's been great how God's really kind of grown this and brought people in that, have such great competencies and experience and expertise. I'm just thankful for the team that I get to collaborate with every day. And, so it started off small and we started doing like this little workshop. And then people said, well, we want to come back, but we want to get to know other people, but we also want this community. Yeah. And then so that grew into this large conference where whenever we've had it, we've had people typically from about 8 countries or more that come into it. And then from there, we started hearing people say, okay, this is great, but now what if I want to do this like as my sense of calling or professionally even? What's the next step? And then so that led to this master's program. And then we do research and we do these other trainings all across the country.
Yeah.
So it's just really kind of evolved.
That's awesome. That's so cool. I want to make sure I'll put the website on for HDI, but if you have some of the resources or something that you feel like, people want to learn more about, feel free. I'll put those on the show notes too. And I just think it's something that people need to know about, right? And
And for people too that are also interested in, so a big part for me is, how do we use research to help inform our decisions and to live more resiliently? So one of the other things, because of my cancer experience, in addition to the book that I've done, that I've also been doing a lot more writing for, different magazines and newspapers and things, trying to break down some of this in ways that are more tangible, for the everyday reader,
sure.
For everyday life disasters. And so if you go to jamieayton.com, you can also find a number of resources there for free.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'll make sure and link all that, make sure people can access all that. Well, I could really talk to you about this all day, right? but I know you have things going on that you should get to. So I end the podcast with 2 final questions. Mm-hmm. So are you ready for the 2?
I don't know
if I've prepped you yet, but so I'm putting you on the spot with these. So my first one is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
strangest job. Yeah. I think, and in fact, it may actually be one of my favorite jobs, was I got to work 2 summers as a paid intern for University of Illinois in their extension service in a small town near where I grew up. And so what that meant was I got to spend the summer working largely like with 4-H groups and other kind of like youth programs. And I got to do everything. And in many ways, actually, a lot of what I do now, I realized a while back that kind of ties back, like I got to like go on the radio and talk about like the fair coming. I got to help organize, you know, all these different leadership groups of youth, you know, to do things. I wrote my first grant while I was there to be able to start like a small like youth leadership program. But as part of those duties, I also had to do things like go judge, like meat judging and go like into like, I remember, and I was like, oh, sure, I'll do that. I'll learn. And then I'm thinking though, like, oh, we're judging cattle.
Yeah.
No. We're going into the lockers after the cattle had been slaughtered and having to judge the meat. Like, and that was by far the strangest thing I have ever done as a paid professional in my life.
Wow. What's the learning curve on judging meat? I mean, it's a, you know, that's a, that seems tricky.
Well, it's the same skill that I learned of as a psychologist, just to turn to the person next to me and be like, what do you think? Or how do you feel about that?
It's good.
So again, the same skill set I learned everything I needed to know in life in 4-H. So
that's a great plug.
Huge proponent of 4-H.
It's a great plug. I love it. Okay. So my final question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom into their work?
I think if you really want to bring God's kingdom into your work, it is to look where there's a need. Hmm. You know, what is that need that just keeps coming up in your life over and over? And also, and when you see that need, it should also be that need that bothers you, that frustrates you, that when you look at it, you know, it just kind of conjures up Micah 6:8, that, you know, that injustice just jumps out at you. And if that, there's that theme to that, I think that's oftentimes where God's calling us. You know, I kind of joked at the beginning of the podcast that, you know, I feel like oftentimes I've been, you know, in the wrong place at the right time. And, you know, I think sometimes that's where God is working in our lives, that it's not always these perfect opportunities where everything's nice and neat. But in my own experience, it's been more about, where has there been those imperfections? Or even in my case, like, where's the pain been? Where's the scars? That I think those are the places sometimes that we're called to step into.
That is such a good word and so appropriate for your story. And I really appreciate that. So thanks. Good stuff. Well, I can't say thanks enough for meeting with me.
Thanks for having me. This has been great. I've enjoyed it.
It's been so fun to hang out and get to know you a little bit.
Yeah, likewise.
So, yeah. All right. Well, thanks again. And I'm sure we'll talk soon. So. Well, I really hope you enjoyed hearing from Jamie. I love this interview so much. I think one of my takeaways at the end, you know, his advice for bringing the kingdom of God into your work, that finding your burden, I think, is just such an important part of it. The more people I interview, the more people I talk to, God just like uses our stories and places these burdens on us. And I think we could all stand to take some time just in prayer and just in self-reflection about like what our burdens truly are and what God has for us. And I think knowing your burden, knowing what you're chasing after, goes a long way towards even just being satisfied with what you do. And so I just encourage you to do that. If you have spent time doing that and you know your burden, let me know. I'd love to hear about it. I'd love to hear what burdens you, what things sort of keep you up at night and cause you to do your work. So maybe on Jamie's post on Instagram or whatever, just shout it out. What burden that God has placed on you. So I hope you enjoyed. And until next time, get out there and hustle.